I really enjoy doing radio. I think it's a lost art. I think there's a lot of red versus blue, right? And that's really served us very ill in our society. And so radio still reaches more people than TV. And I think combining that with video live streaming content, radio plus video live streaming that's available on OTT devices, really is going to be like a vice grip that squeezes the TV mindset out into the ash heap of history. So that's a great thing to know, that the TV mindset is phasing out of society with the combo of the good old classic radio, terrestrial, AM and FM. I'm here on 540 AM and 93.1 FM here in Orlando. You can also find me online on the live stream. But I also wanted to recognize a good friend of mine. On my A Neighbor's Choice radio show, we combine two types of topics. We talk about the victims of state violence, and we recognize the humanity of our neighbors in the thralls of dealing with government regulation, government, criminal law for nonviolent, victimless behaviors. And at the same time, we don't want to stay negative, so we also bring a positive dynamic to the program where we find the innovators, people who are the misfits of society, who are willing to challenge groupthink and science innovation. And to do that, I have my good friend, my chief science advisor here today, Dr. Wei-Ping Yu, theoretical physicist. Please stand. And I thought it would be good to do a little bit of show and tell, because that's always fun to give illustrations. So I've been hearing a lot about how colleges and the government have really, what I would say, they've corrupted knowledge. So I'm going to give you an illustration of that corruption of knowledge in real time today. Dr. Yu has brought with us a device. I'm going to have him stand up. He's going to share it with everyone. This is something you probably have not seen in government-protected official science and innovation. When it comes to green energy, this is a panel. It's a solid-state little panel made of graphite and silicon, and it runs 24/7 and produces energy. Doesn't need sun, doesn't need solar exposure. It's been running. We power a little nightlight in my room almost for a year now, and it self-charges. And the reason why this type of technology is foreign to us is because government has a way of retarding knowledge. They have a way of keeping us in the dark, even when we don't realize it. Because when government has a monopoly on the gatekeepers of what is allowed to be explored scientifically, whether that's the peer review journals, the grants that they give, and of course, the fact that government finances universities, they have the ability to violently expel ideas that challenge the reigning paradigms of knowledge. All human beings are going to be prone to groupthink. All human beings are mimetic, as the title of my talk is. That means they imitate, and they get locked up into what I call almost like a hypnotic state of groupthink. But when you put the presence of a monopoly, which has the privilege of initiating violence, into the mix, you make that proclivity to human groupthink much worse. It makes the natural process of paradigm shifts very difficult to take place. Thomas Kuhn was a scientific philosopher who talked about paradigm shifts. That's where we get that term. And there's a natural cycle in bodies of knowledge, whether it's physics or chemistry or economics or any of these different fields of knowledge, where they have a reigning paradigm and enough anomalies start to build up, which causes doubt in the paradigm. Now, in a free market society, those reigning paradigms would be easily, well, not easily, but there would be an ability to actually swipe out the old paradigm of ideas once it was insufficiently able to answer for the anomalies piling up in a field of research and then shift to a new paradigm. Thomas Kuhn said that people really don't have the right idea about how scientists actually approach their work. The average scientist does not come into their field with this idea of, let me question the foundations of gravity. Let me question the foundations. No, they're taught the established reigning paradigm in their textbooks, and that's fine, because that's how these paradigm shift cycles happen. But when you have a government monopoly that protects that paradigm from competition for dissenting opinions about what's possible in electricity, what is the nature of gravity, what is the nature of magnetism, what's possible with creating rare earth elements, all these questions that we say, oh, they've been settled for 400 years, we have to be very cautious about that. I want you to remember this as one of the key takeaways of my meeting, to be very skeptical of the corruption of knowledge. Even the things that you believe to be established laws of nature, be careful, because it could be that they've been shielded, not intentionally, it's just what humans do. We're locked in groupthink, but with the presence of a monopoly government, they're shielded from dissent. And if we had a free market in scientific exploration, that panel would be further along in development, it would be able to hold more energy, and we would understand that perhaps there's a sea of energy that we have all around us that can be tapped into that doesn't require direct sunlight exposure. But because government controls and acts as a kind of violent expulsion mechanism for the bureaucratic elites in specialist fields of knowledge, we are prevented by the very mechanism of monopoly government from being able to push forward into these other contrarian fields of opinion. And there's a lot of things that economics is one thing, right? Economics, you know, if you want to be at the top of your field in monetary policy at the most prestigious DC connected think tank or university, you can't be an Austrian, can you guys? And, you know, so that's really a key takeaway from this is question the perceived settled science for a whole host of fields, not just the ones we know are shaky like climate science, but also things that we think are taken for granted, like what is gravity? Maybe it's not like we think. So that's settled for that part. The second part I want to talk about is more about kind of answering what you were saying, Jeff. You mentioned that we are kind of heading towards perhaps a solution based on division. And that reminds me of a quote from a man in history. Some of you may have known him. He said, "I came not to bring peace, but a sword." Who said that? Jesus, okay. So Jesus said that. Perhaps what he was planning is actually unfolding. Perhaps the division that we see all around us that seems almost inevitable is some kind of infection that this person, Jesus, started in history. And perhaps that's what we're in the throes of right now, is trying to get our hands around the implications of a project that a man named Jesus of Nazareth started 2,000 years ago that is undermining the logic of violence that underpins our culture. So maybe we're swimming in his fishbowl and we don't even know it. Maybe this is kind of going along with his vision. And not to get into a deterministic view of history, that it's all set in stone, I think Jesus is always asking us to ask the radical question, in participating in his project, do you desire mercy or sacrifice? After all, he told his followers, it was reported, that he said, if you want to know what this is all about, go and learn what it means God desires mercy, not sacrifice. So maybe that's the choice that we have to make as a culture to solve this ever-encroaching government and this ever, more importantly, encroaching culture of shame that we're all in. that's causing this government to grow out of control. So I wanted to give a quote. I think I found the answer to what is it that we stand for, and I found it from Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers. He was the philosopher we should have paid attention to a little more. He says, love is at the root of all things, all learning, all relationships, love or the lack of it. Maybe that's what we should stand for. Maybe when I think about Adam Smith, when he was developing his theory on economics, you know, back then, economics was considered downstream from this frame of moral philosophy. It was a matter of what's right and wrong. And we've detached that. We've detached that from the field of economics. Human action, what's right and wrong? Love or the lack of it? What's going to be the glue that binds us together? So I wrote an article this week. I'm a columnist too. And I wrote an article about how our society is a shame factory. And I kind of focused it on a friend of mine that I've gotten to know through the show and some other work named Craig Cecil. And I want to read this quote that Craig wrote as kind of like a diary and tell you a little bit about him. Craig says, this is just a blurb from a diary that someone posted about him on Facebook. He says, since I'm an experienced sower, tonight I am working on a special project making rape-resistant shower curtains for the prison. This is a man named Craig Cecil. He's in prison for life without possibility of parole because he was doing body work on trucks that were moving marijuana. He never tried the product. He never touched the product. But because he wanted to go to trial and exercise his alleged right in the Constitution, they threw the book at him. Everybody who actually moved the marijuana themselves are all out now. But he's still in there for life. And he's told me how he's watched murderers come and go while he's still there. And what is he asked to do in this prison camp where he makes a few cents an hour? He's asked to make rape-resistant shower curtains. What argument do we need to make about the state to make this sink in for society? The biggest specialty of our state that they're forcing this man to make for cents in every hour is rape-resistant shower curtains for moving a plant, or not even doing that, just fixing their bodywork. Now, Craig is a wonderful man, and he's got a sweet spirit, given what he's gone through. Definitely grace under fire. And I've enjoyed getting to know him. I have him call on the radio show and others like in his situation. But I think, what else do we need to say? I just want you to think about that. Our government has prison camps where people like him, for victimless behaviors, are making rape-resistant shower curtains. Why are we putting human beings who have no victim on their police report for some alleged crime, why are we putting them in rape-adjacent showers to begin with? Why is that happening? I want you to ask the question, is our society motivated by love or the lack of it? What motivates the people that guard the showers that Craig has to make the curtains for? What motivates the system that acts like this is an ugly inconvenience that we shouldn't speak of? Is it love or the lack of it? So maybe our answer is cultural. Maybe we need to step back and think about where we're building our culture. The ancient kingdoms of primitive society, they didn't have the concern that all of us probably share for the plight of the man thrown into the prisons like Craig. If you went 2,000 years ago, you wouldn't have a conference at a place of learning in which an individual would stand up and say, I'm concerned about the treatment of a prisoner. I'm concerned about his condition there. That wasn't a thing. That's 2,000 years ago, and even a little bit afterwards. Still wasn't a thing. It took a while for Jesus' project to catch on. We are slow to learn as a species and slow to unravel the foundations of our culture. But think about that. We've moved in a trajectory. Something has happened in history where for tens of thousands of years, you had no concern for the least of these, for the victims. It's like if you're in prison, you're in prison there because the gods hate you and you deserve it. And there's no concern for your well-being, and we're certainly not even going to work on special shower curtains to protect you. We're throwing you to the lion's den, or perhaps if you're unfortunate, you're thrown into the next gladiator game with lions. But Jesus saw that, and he said, I've come to make the least of these. Many of the least shall be first, and many of the last shall be Many of the least shall be first, and the first shall be last. So he wanted to change that. And I think that's happening. Because if you think about it, we have made progress. I mean, what would we do before when we wanted to have a good time? In the ancient world, you might go to the gladiator games and watch people torn piece to piece. Now we have simulated football. We have really nice big cushions for protecting your head. Simulated violence in football. And what's happening there? They're not changing the. They're not making it. People in today's time, they're not concerned about. What they are. They are concerned about victims. They're concerned about concussions. They're concerned about what's going on with football players. Whereas in before, if you went to a game and you saw a gladiator in the Roman times, right? In the Roman times, would you be concerned about their concussions? Right? So something happened in our culture, and I've given you the clue of what I think it is, which is the project Jesus inaugurated. By the way, this doesn't require you to have a theological position on Jesus. It doesn't require you to make spiritual claims about Jesus. I'm dealing in the world of anthropology when I talk about this. I'm talking about what has happened to change our cultural appetites, to change what we come together, to bind ourselves together. I remember watching a recent interview with Laura Ingraham and Clarence Thomas, the Justice of the Supreme Court. And he said, she was asking him about the football protests of the anthem. And Clarence Thomas said something very insightful for the purpose of this discussion. He said that nothing binds us together anymore. Nothing binds us together. Used to be, you went to the flag at the game, and that was the place of reverent unity. We put aside our difficulties, we all stand for the flag. And that flag is a symbol that represents the unity, the indivisible unity of the glory of our nation. That's what many people put into that flag. And that doesn't unite us anymore. Now that has been tainted with profane division. There's a sword breaking that apart. We can't even enjoy that anymore. We can't even enjoy our cathartic football games anymore without being worried about how they're treating their spouses or how their concussions are feeling or how people they know have been victimized by the state. Everything that used to bind us together is coming undone. What mechanism in society for 2,000 years has been undermining those original acceptances of violence and the ability to see our neighbor as ourselves and to love our neighbor as ourselves? I think that we would do well to, as a community concerned with liberty and non-aggression and hopefully non-vengeance, to really study anthropology, to study what it means to have culture. Where did culture originate from? If we don't have an anthropology informing our economics, we might miss some of the foundations of why our message is so important and how we can effectively communicate that message and bring people towards a more peaceful and just society. So when I look at anthropology, I'm informed by the work of René Girard. He's a French anthropologist who passed away a few years ago. He taught at Stanford University. And he informs a lot of my insights on anthropology, which I've been kind of, you know, harmonized into my other views of politics and economics. But Girard was keen to understand that the primordial passion which moved humans and still moves our passion has to do with envy and jealousy. Ancient communities, they weren't just like nefariously diabolical, although they did things like that, diabolical, you know, sacrifice. They were trying to stave off the means of runaway jealousy, runaway resentment, runaway contagious envy for our neighbor's possessions and our neighbor's sense of being. And ancient communities kind of stumbled into a way of containing that raging, out of control jealousy, which, if left unchecked, would be and has been in history somewhat like what Hobbes would call the war of all against all. Human beings imitate each other. We imitate each other better than any other animal species out there. And when we imitate, it can quickly spiral into an unending cycle of violence and revenge, often motivated by jealousy. So ancient communities, they stumbled on a way of channeling all of their aggression into a common scapegoat, a common target, a vessel of wrath in which a community could bind themselves together. There's that word again. Remember Clarence Thomas? What? Nothing binds us together anymore, said the head, one of these heads of state of our society. Binding us together. That's what ancient communities were trying to do with this inauguration of strict hierarchical societies mediated by ritual human sacrifice. In fact, communities, if you look in the archaeological evidence, communities where there was no, and this is going back to the earliest stages of human civilization, we see that it's a, make a case that people, communities that didn't practice sacrifice and didn't have evidence of ritual cannibalism, which is tied into sacrifice, they ceased to exist. It's almost like without channeling their aggression into a common victim or target of blame, they would just eat each other alive. Because you get, it's just, and we see this. I mean, look at how we are compared to, say, wolves. If you have two wolves battling for the supremacy of a pack, when the beta wolf loses, he presents his neck for the alpha wolf, but the alpha doesn't take it. Typically, there's a dominance and submission mechanism which kicks in, which prevents it from spiraling out of control. But what do we humans do, right? If you kill my cousin, I'm going to go back and kill your whole family. And then a generation later, you're going to go wipe out my tribe, right? And that goes on and on and on until we have to have Camp David Accords or whatever, right? That doesn't work. But, you know, you have these continual cycles of vengeance that take place without a controlled sacrificial lynching. That's the way human societies maintained and contained jealousy and resentment. But unfortunately, it was a lie. Because as we've seen with Craig Cecil, who is the scapegoat of our times, because that's what the state is, it's a vestige of that sacrificial mechanism. Craig Cecil, we have a concern for him. As a society, we're no longer unified at the idea that he deserves his situation. We have division. We have a sword of radical love that's permeating our society that when humans see someone in this situation, many of them, not all, but many of them say, I stand on the side of him. Let him go. And so that's breaking apart the state. And the state is no longer trusted. There's no longer a cathartic release when we think of the state. Think about the wars we have. They're losing their luster every year. I mean, it's like you had like the last swan song was Saddam Hussein, where you kind of partially unified, or Osama bin Laden, I guess, was the closest. But even those wars soured quickly and created division. There was no 100% unanimity. In the ancient world, when you had a plague or a famine, and you said, look at that witch, that person must be a demon, and you all started throwing rocks at her, there wasn't a minority report. It's like, okay, that was the cause of our bad blood between each other. She put a spell on us, or he, or whatever. And we're good now. We feel relief. We feel a sacred unity, a bond. Well, that's what's being lost now, because Jesus is beating the state. And more importantly, he's beating the culture that produced the state. Now, it's not like you get to sit on the Disney ride and go on autopilot. We have a choice about how we participate in this project, whether you're religious or not. Everybody wants to imitate Jesus. Even if you don't even believe he's a real person, you still want to imitate what is described about him and what his ethic of social order should be. So that's what's happening. It's unraveling before our eyes. And the reason why the state is, you know, not binding us together, it's slipping apart. And what's happening is, as it breaks apart, the envy that the old sacred mechanism of the state, it's all starting to pour out. The envy, the reciprocal resentment that used to be contained within sacred violence, when everybody believed that the state was just in all of its wars and all of its laws and all of its behaviors and treatments towards misfits, whether they're rich or poor, whether they're violating raw milk laws or drug laws, whatever it is, we used to be more convinced that they were right. But the more we become influenced and work out the aesthetic and the ethic of the project that Jesus inaugurated in history, the more it loses its ability to bind us together. And so now we see why we have what I call victimism or social justice, right? That is the hell, that is the primordial fire of finger pointing and envy and trying to tear down and break apart that the old hierarchies that were mediated by sacrifice contained. So this is not an autopilot thing where we sit back in apathy and just say, oh, well, if Jesus, whoever this figure is, if he's created a project that's influencing our law and our ethic and our aesthetic, what concerns us as a culture, we just sit back and wait. No, because we can learn to answer the question of, do we desire mercy or sacrifice? We can learn to answer that question the easy way or the hard way. We can sit around and say, you know, I'm not going to fight and stand in solidarity of the victims. Or we can, you know, we can say that, or we can actually get to work and actually fight for victims and humanize them and tell their stories. And so that's what the final piece of what I'd love to leave with you is, just think about how you can tell a victim of state violence, tell their story. Not everyone wants to do radio. Not everybody wants to do social media or podcasting. But whatever you do, try to find the victims of state violence, whether it's someone who has their house, you know, regulated to death and they have to lose their house because of some city ordinance, or whether it's a big dramatic case like someone in life, prison for life for a nonviolent drug-related offense. Whatever it is, tell their story. Because humans, as I said earlier, are mimetic, they're imitative. And so when you stand on the side of a victim, you say, this man's innocent, or this woman's innocent, and they're not guilty, they're not deserving of violence, I don't have to agree with their behavior, I don't have to like their vice, but I'm not going to harm them physically. I'm not going to put them in a PTSD cage or take their money. What's that going to do? It's stupid, it's absurd. And we all know this, but the problem is, humans are always going to be locked in a bystander effect unless someone, including all of us, gets out there in whatever way you can, stand in solidarity with the victims of state violence. Let me give you an illustration of this. There's a story I remember of a man. He's a homeless man, and he had a heart attack, and he was cardiac arrest, and he was sitting in the middle of like New York City. And everybody just kept walking past him in a bystander, locked in groupthink. That's the mimetic contagion that's always happening in so many ways. He was sitting there dying, basically, and there you just watch people passing by. But then one man stopped, and he looked, and he saw the man, and he went to his aid. And as he did that, suddenly everybody else around him started to imitate. It's like they caught his contagious desire to help his neighbor. And suddenly they were out of the trance of kind of like a group think. I'm just going to keep moving because everybody's keep moving. They're not even thinking that way on a conscious level, most of them. All of a sudden they can see what he sees. And they have concern for his safety as he has concern. And so they imitated him and the man was able to live. And that's what you do whenever you tell the story of someone that you find out, whether it's in your local city or someone federally, tell their story, stand up for them, give them a chance to speak. Post, you know, if you find that, you know, Craig Cecil has a group of people who post his writings on Facebook. So get in there and share people's stories of people who have been, you know, wrongfully persecuted by the state. Because that has a magnetic power in and of itself. That you think, well, what, that's it? Well, no, that's not it. You also have to get to work and help solve the problems that our government says they can solve alone, which is where I get back to what I showed with Dr. Yu. Getting your hands, getting your skin in the game and solving real world problems like energy or resources or medicine. The state says, for example, well, we have to sacrifice people like Craig or other people who violate our rules of medicine, because if we let people have freedom, then God forbid what they'll do. It'll be chaos. There'll be snake oil salesmen around every corner. And so they say, we have to sacrifice some for the benefit of the few. That's the logic of the state. But what happens if you, like I was illustrating with Dr. Yu, you challenge the group think of what's possible in medicine, which has been protected by the state. For example, we've interviewed a friend over in another country in England who is working on like antibiotics, generic antibiotics for cancer. He's finding them to be 100 times more effective than chemo when you combine them in conjunction with vitamin C. Now he's doing clinical trials. He's doing the initial human trials and everything. It's a nascent thing, but that's not the paradigm of medicine that the state's going to fund. You have to be bold enough to be willing to be a scapegoat and say, no, I disagree with the reigning paradigm of knowledge. There's truth in it, but maybe there's a better way that's not currently propped up by state protection and state handouts and state peer review papers and all that other stuff. And so you see how if we do two things, tell the victim story, stand in solidarity with the victims of state violence, and two, either you or find people that you can seek out, like our friends, who are solving the problems for our society that the state will never be able to solve, and solve them better, solve them cheaper, and solve them in a much more beautiful way. Thank you all very much.